Hey, what's going on? It's At The Letters for Wednesday, March 24th. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith, our producers Christian Ryan and Mike Tassoni. Ben, lots going on in Blue Jays land right now as team wraps up spring training in Dunedin, Florida. Lots going on for us as well. In the back half of this podcast, we're going to have our interview with Ross Stripling that we recorded a few days ago and talk to Ross about a whole bunch of interesting things about him on the field and off. So you can get that in the second half of the episode. But for now, Ben, like, just crazy torrent of Blue Jays news this week, man. Like, how when you get this kind of huge news dump, on one day, like, how do you kind of keep things in perspective?
Yeah, it's a lot to make sense of right away. Like, immediately after that happens, I try to just picture the depth chart that the Blue Jays have, how it's impacted, what areas they have the biggest weaknesses in. And, now, obviously, the bullpen would be at the top of that list, but not the only spot, as I'm sure we'll get to in the next little bit. But, you're kind of making calls right away, organizing from a work standpoint. We recorded an instant analysis right afterwards. As you're doing that, you're trying to make sense of what it means for this team. Because to have a day like that, where you have all kinds of injury updates, most of them negative, I mean, that definitely shifts the outlook for this team a little bit.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of sticker shock, right, when it all kind of comes in a wave. But, like, I would argue that it's not that bad. The worst news is Kirby Yates, obviously, yeah. Right? Like, Tommy John surgery, going to miss the season. Like, that's terrible news for him. It's the second of his career. It's awful news for the team, which is counting on him to be its closer. We'll touch on that. But, like, bigger picture, like, George Springer has an oblique issue. He's already played through it. He can play through it. He's got a week and a half to get right for opening day. Robbie Ray has a bruised elbow, but he's only expected to miss the one spring start. He's already, like, kind of scheduled to throw a bullpen this weekend. Pretty encouraging news on Nate Pearson, who's back on a mound, and Thomas Hatch, who appears to have, avoided a grave injury. I mean, Kevin Biggio's finger is, like, not expected to be a major thing. Like, it's believed to be very minor, and the team's just being very cautious right now. So, like, the only thing that's, like, really truly, like, changed and is really truly impactful in a major way, honestly, is that Kirby Yates won't be available to the Toronto Blue Jays in 2021. But I mean, it's not like they had him for a while and now have to deal with the loss of him. They just never even really had him at all. The rest of it is not good, but it's kind of relatively minor in nature. Do you agree with me on that?
I do agree with that. I think that, it's like you have one major setback. Last time we talked, Kirby Yates was on track to be the Blue Jays closer. He was someone who brought tremendous upside potential to this bullpen. And now he's not going to throw a pitch for the Toronto Blue Jays probably in his whole career. So that's bad. That's not good. Then you go beyond that to some of the other players, Ray and Springer and Biggio. And in those cases, it's kind of like you're pushing them back a little bit. You're nudging them back, but it doesn't totally change their outlook for the season. Based on the information that we're getting from the Blue Jays right now, it seems like those guys are on track to mostly have full healthy seasons. So basically, what we're looking at is the loss of their best reliever and then some adjustments plus or minus on some of the other players. But losing your best reliever is never a good thing.
Well, and you think about it, like, even just in the greater context of the Blue Jays have had a relatively healthy spring, up until obviously like the last couple of days.
Right. Yeah.
But Patrick Murphy was kind of the yep. one guy who is, missing significant time. Thomas Hatch comes out of that outing the other day. It looks bad. Turns out it's better than it, kind of looked on face value. So, like, the big one obviously is Yates. And look, second Tommy John surgery of his career, second consecutive lost season for him, right? You consider he only made like a half dozen appearances last year and clearly wasn't himself. Like, it gets back to what we were talking about last week about, every pitcher is pitching hurt. Everybody is somewhere.
More so than we knew.
Right? But like, everybody is somewhere on that spectrum of injured. And it's just like, how far are you and what can you get through? Like, how much discomfort and inflammation can you go out and do your job with? And like, he had off-season surgery to remove bone chips from his elbow, then obviously had the strain in the flexor that, the spring that was of a concern as well. And the club was obviously being cautious with him, right? They brought him along slowly, didn't make a spring debut until, maybe like a week and a half into games, and then had that big kind of gap between outings. And then, the velocity was down and, it's kind of eyebrow raising. Like, it's all super unfortunate. You really do have to feel for the guy, just considering his career arc, right? Considering like how far he's come from being, you know, undrafted. And I mean, I don't know how many times this guy's been DFA'd, but you know, three or four at least. And you know, you think about how many times he's probably been claimed on waivers and traded, you know, and not like traded for, you know, prospects, like traded for like cash mm-hmm. or like player to be named later type of deal. How many organizations he's basically been, you know, kind of like holding on by his fingernails to his career with. And then suddenly in 2019, he's like the best closer in the game, right? Like he discovers a splitter that nobody can hit. And all of a sudden it's like all-star Cy Young votes, leading baseball in saves. And then everything that has happened since has just been like really unfortunate. So like it sucks and there's no way around it. I really do hope we see Kirby Yates back on a big league mound again in 12 to 18 months, whenever he gets back from this procedure. And I do hope there is like one last burst of really effective relief in his career, just considering everything the guy's been through.
For sure. And in the meantime, the Jays pay him $5.5 million. So that's a nice amount of money to make for Kirby Yates. Yeah. At the same time, though, he would have had a chance to make a lot more if he had had a healthy season. And the money aside, as you said, professionally, big setback for Yates. And so this is the second consecutive year now that the Blue Jays have lost their closer to Tommy John and lost their most established, most accomplished reliever. Ken Giles, of course, last year went down and the Jays were in a similar spot where they had to make it up on the fly with Dolis, Romano. At the time, it was Anthony Bass. Now, you know, maybe we see David Phelps in that role. I don't know about you, Arden, but to me, I don't expect that the Jays are going to name a closer. I expect that even within the first 2 weeks of the season, we're going to see multiple relievers get saves because I just don't see a ton of urgency to make that determination of capital T, capital C, the closer.
No, it's 2021, man. Like we can get out of this stuff with, you know, that's my inning, right? Like assigning particular innings to particular guys. Like I just think it's kind of silly, honestly. And I think going forward, you know, you're going to see progressive teams more and more operating without like true defined closers. Like I think sometimes you do have a veteran guy like a Kirby Yates, who's like in his mid 30s, has been very successful in that role. Perhaps he has, you know, expressed to you that he'd be most comfortable in a defined role. Fine. You can work with that. But, you know, everyone else, I think, has to be ready for anything because as we've established, like leverage exists all throughout a ball game. The first inning is a leverage inning. You look historically at ERAs in the first inning runs scored, no OPSs. So, you know, I just think the modern high leverage reliever has to understand that, you know, you can come into a ball game at really any point. I mean, Jordan Romano was talking to us about that the other night. He was saying he actually kind of enjoys not knowing and having it sprung on him. So I don't think there's really any sense in saving a guy like a Romano or a Dolis or a Phelps and saying you are getting the ninth inning. Like when we get that lead, you're coming in. Like I just think that, you know, those guys can get high leverage outs at any point in a ball game. You know, if you're facing leverage in the seventh, you need the outs desperately. You got a guy out there or, you know, you got some batters coming up who you know are going to struggle against sliders. Jordan Romano, man, get a great slide and a great fastball. Maybe it's guys coming up who are really going to struggle against, you know, kind of sinkers and stuff that moves down the zone. Well, maybe Rafael Dolis is your guy in that spot. I think you're just playing matchups and you're getting the outs when you need them.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the best way to go. I think that's the way the Blue Jays will go. And then there's going to have to be someone at the bottom end of that bullpen mix, right? Someone who is that eighth or ninth reliever who now gets an opportunity. And so is that Francisco Liriano or Tim Mazza, or do they select AJ Cole? You know, is it somebody like Castro who they picked up on waivers? He's had a really good spring in the course of, you know, the last few weeks for the Jays. So a few directions that they could go, but that's really the shift that you're looking at, right? Because the guys like Phelps or Baraki or Romano, they were in the bullpen anyway. They were going to pitch anyway. So the change is you're substituting Yates for one of these newcomers who's now going to get that last spot.
You mentioned Anthony Castro. I was talking to somebody recently who said Anthony Castro has like put himself on the map in a big way. This, like, I don't know the Blue Jays necessarily coming into spring were expecting him to be, you know, as much of a player in this bullpen picture as he is, but he is a guy who it's so rare that you see somebody in camp like pitch themselves into consideration these days, but he very much has. Like, he's up against it to make it for the opening day roster, certainly, but Anthony Castro is going to get outs out of this bullpen at some point this season. And the Blue Jays feel like really, really strongly about what he's done, and they feel really good about the fastball that he's shown. So that's very encouraging. The results are there as well, as you alluded to.
Absolutely. I think he's a guy to watch. And I don't know where you land on this as you see some of these, you know, some of this hype around the Blue Jays pitching in the last little while. And it's great. Like, it's better than not that Robbie Ray, before his bruised elbow, was able to go out there and throw with increased velocity. And it's better than not that Steven Matz has good results, or that Tyler Chatwood does. I don't quite buy it, to be totally honest. Like, yeah. I haven't really changed my opinion on these guys. I have a little bit on Robbie Ray because the velo was up.
Process.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's still spring training. Like, when you see, and I'm not trying to like dunk on people who are tweeting like these hype tweets about these guys, because I mean, good for them. They have good numbers in spring. They're doing well, but I still haven't totally changed my opinion as far as those guys. So then when someone like Castro steps up, that's a good thing.
Yeah, process, because it's how he's doing it, right? It's the velocity, and it's the fastball. It's also, you know, it's the conversations you and I are having with people who are actually there and watch these guys and making these decisions. But like, when I see a guy who is, you know, working with increased velocity, as you said, or who's, you know, attacking hitters and getting ahead, like with Robbie Ray, just being in the zone, man, and throwing strikes, yeah. Right? Like, because it's tough to hide from that if you're scattering it or if you are actually attacking the zone. Like, that's the stuff that matters right now more so than results, you know? Like, and it's, look, like you said, like, it's impossible to paint this spring as anything but wildly successful for Robbie Ray up until he fell down the stairs. But, you know, like, I just, the process is there. Same thing with Matz, man. Like, the guy is getting into tough spots where, you know, he gives up a double to Bryce Harper. And that's a situation where, quite literally, with Bryce Harper at the plate last year in starts, like, things spiraled for him and things went poorly. And this year he has shown an improved mental approach and an improved resiliency in those moments of adversity. Does that carry over into the regular season? We'll see. But those are like the process things that, you know, are kind of are pretty encouraging behind some of these results.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, we'll see how it translates when it counts. I think that it's going to lead to some interesting over-unders, which we'll be doing next week on the podcast. I sent out a tweet, but anyone who wants to contribute, we're going to have a few listener submissions for those. So if you want to send in an over-under, we're going to pick a few from listeners. So I will retweet my own tweet. It'll be up at the top of my timeline, and check that out and reply if you've got any.
One more on Kirby Yates before we tie up George Springer and then get to Ross Stripling. But with Yates, I mean, how do you kind of reflect now on the deal that the Blue Jays signed him to this offseason? Because, like, look, the club obviously was aware of the risk with Kirby Yates. Like, you look at the deal they signed him to: 1 year, $5.5 million, 4.5 in incentives. The only guarantee is the $5.5 million. So you compare that to like Trevor Rosenthal getting $11 million and Brad Hand getting $11 million. Archie Bradley got like six, right? In a guarantee. I mean, Yates could have exceeded it in incentives, but I'm going to deal with just guarantee, because that's all you're guaranteeing the guy. None of those guys I mentioned have accomplished what Kirby Yates did in 2019. Like, none of them have had a season like that. So I think that the contract like speaks to an understanding that there was significant risk here. And I mean, even as part of like a physical process or an intake process, like, you do an MRI on a guy, yep, you know, and for the, like, because clubs want to take a look under the hood and see what's going on. So the Blue Jays were well aware of how much UCL Kirby Yates was working with here. Like, the same doctor who is, you know, diagnosing him now and recommending, you know, procedures for him now is the doctor who did the intake process when Kirby Yates was signing with the Blue Jays. So everyone knew what they were signing up for, and we've established that all pitchers are hurt to some degree. So I guess, like, considering all that information, like, how do you kind of look back on the Blue Jays process and signing this deal, which has now obviously ended up with like essentially the worst possible outcome?
Right. Yeah. So I think, with the obvious caveats that I didn't look at the MRIs, and if I had, I wouldn't have had any idea,
yeah,
what to do with them. So, you know, there's a certain amount of leap of faith you have to take with making some assumptions about the medicals. Okay. So with that being said, at the time, knowing what we did at the time when they made that deal, I still think it was a good deal. I actually still think it was a really good deal. I mean, you're looking for some upside. They already had some depth relievers. They wanted to add some impact. He had that potential. The cost was, in the context of major league salaries, quite modest. So I like it as an upside play. I'll give it an 8 out of 10 for process. And for results, it is a resounding 0 out of 10. And I think those things are compatible. I, you know, maybe you view it differently, I don't know. But like, to me, it's just like, obviously it didn't work out, but all right, they took their shot. It just totally collapsed on them.
The result to me is like a 1 out of 10, because at least you got Kirby Yates like around your facility in spring.
That's right? A generous, you got something. 1 out of 10.
You got a couple outings out of him in spring. You didn't get literally nothing, right?
Well,
couple
out, you got, you know,
you've got Jordan Amano on the Zoom talking about how much he's learned from him, right? And you've got him in the room talking to guys. Like, you got something.
Yeah, we'll give it a 0.5 out of 10 then on the ATL average.
But you can like, so it's not like, you know, Trevor Rosenthal is this like super safe bet either at $11 million. Yeah. Like, they're relievers, right? And they're pitchers. So, you know, they're all veterans who have been injured, and they're all, you know, pitching in the category of player in this game that is most susceptible to volatility in terms of performance and health. So, you know, like, is Brad Hand going to be the guy that he's been for the last several years? I mean, like, I'm sure he hopes so, but you know, there's no guarantee of that. Yeah. Like, relievers can fall off a cliff. We've seen it too many times. So there's always a lot of risk in any relief pitcher deal. So if anything, you can like paint, admittedly, a rather generous portrait and portrayal, but admittedly, one where the Blue Jays actually had less risk with Kirby Yates at $5.5 million than they would have with like Liam Hendricks at, you know, 3 years and the number escapes me, or, you know, Rosenthal at a year and 11, like at just 5.5 for the 1 year. They got the worst possible outcome, sure, but it doesn't mean there aren't bad outcomes coming for those other guys as well. At the end of the day, none of us can predict this stuff reliably going forward, particularly with free agent relievers.
Which is one reason why the Jays have been hesitant to go multiple years on free agent pitchers. We saw them obviously do it with Ryu, which looks good, with Roer, which does not look good. And otherwise, you know, you look at this offseason, the pitchers they added were on one-year deals. And I don't think that was an accident. So it is a way to mitigate risk, but you never escape it fully. That's just the reality of trying to build a major league team.
You mentioned it, like last year, the Blue Jays lost their closer to Tommy John surgery, yeah, literally just last season. And oh, by the way, they made the playoffs, you know, expanded field, et cetera. Yeah, I get it, right? But ultimately, when you're replacing a reliever, even your closer, you're looking at most 60 innings that you're looking to replace. And in a season, you have like 1,500 innings, somewhere around there total. So you're talking about like 5% of the innings, probably even less actually, doing the math in my head, that you're looking to replace for the seasons. Like, look, they're important innings, certainly, but they're not as important as like Hyunjin Ryu's innings. You know, they aren't as like irreplaceable as those. It just means more leverage ultimately for kind of that second tier of guy, right? Whereas like Dolis and Romano were always going to be facing leverage, Rocky too. Now it's a bit more leverage for Tyler Chatwood, right? And a little bit more for David Phelps. And I mean, it could mean some more leverage for, hey, if an Anthony Castro is on this team in late April or in May, maybe he's facing some leverage at the majors. Maybe it's more leverage for Julian Merriweather, or once Patrick Murphy is healthy. Like, I think his profile is perfectly suited for leverage in the majors if the Blue Jays, you know, don't want to continue developing him as a starter this year, want to use him that way. Maybe Ty Tice gets some shots this year and gets to be kind of like that up and down guy at the edge of the bullpen, right in the shuttle. Maybe Alek Manoah over the back half of the season, if he's gotten some good development done as a starter through, you know, June, July, it's August, September, you need a big arm in the back end of your bullpen. Here's Alek Manoah to come in and gas it out. Like, the Blue Jays just have a lot of options to fill this void with Kirby Yates. And it's really only 60 innings, which isn't the, you know, you can handle that, I think, as a club, even with, not to mention, acquisitions in season or acquisitions in the coming weeks. Like, don't forget, Daniel Hudson was acquired at the end of spring training a couple of years ago and then ended up pitching in the World Series and signing like a 2-year, $11 million deal the following offseason. Hudson was on waivers, or maybe he was actually already released and signed, yeah, got him for nothing at the end of spring training and became a piece in their bullpen. So these things take care of themselves.
They do. And I think that they become a little bit easier too when you're able to go out and pursue some help. And it sounds like the Jays want to do that along the lines of that Hudson example, which is, you know, a good reminder that these things are possible. And the deal might appear minor at the time, but as you said, there's the potential for that to become a bigger move over the course of the season. And certainly, you know, I think they need more help. I think that they should be looking outside the organization, trying to add more arms to that group. Then you option Castro. He's there as your reserve. He's not starting the season with you as a guy that you're necessarily counting on. But as an overall kind of reaction to the pitching status, including Pearson, including Hatch, I think things are okay. I don't think they're better than okay. Like, I don't think this is good at all. It's obviously, you know, these are setbacks we're mostly talking about here, but I think it's okay. And they've got to be pretty careful now because, you know, they don't want to be in a position where TJ Zoik is necessarily like in that big league rotation, which they're a little precariously close to.
Quickly, let's touch on George Springer. Speaking of being careful, you know, this is a guy who was battling some abdominal tightness earlier this spring, obviously missed that game with it, and then it was like back the next day, like crushing a ball over the left field wall. Running around in the outfield, but it seems like symptoms lingered. Blue Jays sent him for an MRI. Guy's got a grade 2 oblique strain, but apparently is not experiencing the symptoms that one might expect from it, is not as limited by it as possible. So it's kind of created this interesting scenario where the Blue Jays have this clear and defined injury that they want to be mindful of and they want to be careful of, and they don't want to become worse as the season goes on. Meanwhile, they've got this player who's like, no, I can play, I'm good. Like, I'm fine. I can swing the bat and I can be out there and I can get all my work in and I can help this team. Like, as an organization, like, Ben, how do you kind of manage that push-pull of obviously wanting to be mindful and careful, but then also having this player who's saying, no, I'm good to play?
It is a weird one, right? Where the MRI results just don't seem to be lining up with how Springer appears to be describing his own experience of the injury. So I think the answer is you take it day by day to start, and you see if these 3-4 days of rest help him. And if it's not improving, then I really do think you have to start him on the IL. And you can backdate it. If you backdate it, then he can miss 6 games. So that would mean, you know, 10-day IL stint, it's only costing you 6 games. It's not the worst. It's definitely not the best. You know, best case scenario is him playing one, you know, being available from the first week of the season and helping the Blue Jays in that first series against the Yankees. And now that's looking less likely, still on the table. But I think you just go day by day and you have to be prepared to say, all right, we're giving him a rest. This is not what we wanted, but we're going to give him a rest.
Here's the thing, Ben, like, you take another MRI this weekend, it's not going to show anything different.
Yeah.
You're not going to have, like, all of a sudden, oh yeah, that grade 2 strain is gone. Like, it's still going to be there. Like, that's just physics. Like, that's just how this stuff works. That's just biology. So, you know, it sounds like with George Springer, like, if it's up to him, he will play opening day. And like, you totally understand that, right? Like, he's proven he can play through it and he wants to take the field, and it's admirable, his willingness to play through injury. But if you're the club, man, like, I just think you have to take the long view.
Yeah.
And I think you probably have to take the decision out of George Springer's hands. And you have to say, look, we're going to hold you out, man. Oh, you're going to start the year on the IL. Or like, you could kind of do a little bit of like a soft solution where it's like, okay, you're on the roster, but you're not going to play on opening day. And remember, the Blue Jays have that off day on day 2 of the season. So they could carry George Springer on opening day, not play him. Then you got another day after that. And then you can really reassess and say, okay, are we comfortable now with, on, you know, game 2, day 3 of the season, George Springer going ahead and starting as a DH and working his way back in? Or do we have to look at backdating the IL, like you said, so we can get a reliever up here? Like, I think that is the most likely outcome here, because as the Blue Jays, you don't want this to be something that, even if it isn't bothering George Springer right now, and even if the symptoms aren't that bad right now, you don't want it to be something that's progressively getting worse throughout the season and that he is carrying and playing through. You can ask Marcus Semien how that goes. Yeah. He tried to do the same thing last year. And look at his numbers from the first month of the season. It doesn't end well.
Right, exactly. And I mean, if you're going to rest him that opening day, then you can just put him on the IL, have him miss 3 more. Like, it's only 3 more games at that point. I don't know. And then you have the use of that roster spot, and you're not putting, like, at a certain point, like, if he's not ready to go on opening day, I think you just IL personally.
My idea with that sort of like soft solution was just like, if that's what's going to make it tenable to him, because it sounds like he's very motivated.
Oh yeah.
There, right.
And that's a factor.
And look, this is your franchise player. This is a $150 million guy, right? So like, he's a major stakeholder in this. And, you know, even in the way the Blue Jays have been kind of messaging it publicly, like, you can tell, like, they're being very, you know, conscious of his desires. And that's admirable, right? The guy's a, you know, big free agent offseason signing. He wants to play. He wants to be in center field on opening day in the Bronx, have his name called and announced, and be digging into the box as the first Blue Jays hitter of the season against Gerrit Cole Like, yep. That's all great, but you got to, it's a 6-month season, man. Like, it's not, what's more important, George Springer, you know, being there in the Bronx on opening day, or even like being in Texas in the second series of the season, or being at, you know, the first game at Dunedin, is that more important, or is it more important that George Springer is like as close to, you know, healthy and 100%, because no player's ever 100%, but like as close to that as possible in July and in right. August and September? Like, there's plenty of time to play through injuries this year. Like, I promise you, George, you will get to play through bumps and bruises yeah. and knocks a ton. Just wait for August, wait for September, wait for the postseason, because that's when you're really going to be like dragging ass to get out of bed and like get through BP and everything you have to do in a day. Now in April is not the time. Now is the time to take care of anything like this and not let it get worse.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that goes for all these guys, you know, Ray, Springer, Pearson, Hatch, you know, and Biggio. In the meantime, Biggio, yeah. You know, of course that same logic applies, but you got to make sure that you have enough guys taking the field and being healthy. And the Jays believe that they can do that. And it's going to be really fun to see if that can happen or not.
Yeah, it's a lot of minor knocks in Blue Jays camp right now, but I wouldn't say that it's more than other teams are seeing. Like, I think it is actually a pretty standard rate of injury that the Blue Jays are experiencing right now.
Yeah.
Just my opinion.
I think it's within the realm of normal on the high end.
Fair enough. Let's take a break. But when we come back, we are going to talk to Toronto Blue Jays starter Ross Stripling, who's kind enough to join us on the pod this week. All that and so much more. And we continue on At The Letters. Ross Stripling joins us on At The Letters. And Ross, I always thank our guests for making the time for us, but I guess that particularly for you, considering you're not only a new father, not only having had a kid during a pandemic and a generational snowstorm in Texas, you're not only at spring training with a new team, trying to make an impression, trying to catch up after being a little bit late. You might have a start in the opening week of the season, not only during all the COVID protocols and everything, the weirdest spring training anyone's ever seen. I think I really do sincerely need to thank you for making the time. You can't have much of it on your hands these days.
Yeah, I'm a busy man. And first off, Ben, Arden, thanks for having me, man. You know what? Yeah, sometimes I bite off more than I can chew, that's for sure. But right now, my little man Jackson's taking a nap, so I can fit in a little 20, 30-minute interview here with you guys and have some fun.
That's awesome. Yeah, we definitely appreciate it. And, you know, of all of the guests that we've had, it's pretty rare for us to have another podcaster on the podcast. So I wanted to ask you about your own podcast, obviously, one that's gotten a lot of traction. We saw Bo Bichette on it recently. Clayton Kershaw's been on it. And so I wanted to ask, what led you to start the Big Swing podcast and where it is today?
Yeah, so you guys certainly know the grind that is podcasting and finding the time to record and then obviously produce and put the episode up on the platforms and then to find guests. All that goes into it is tough. How I got into it was I have a buddy, he's my co-host on the Big Swing. His name's Cooper Searles, and we're buddies from back home in Houston. We both went to A&M together. Our wives are basically best friends. And we were sitting at a Rockets game, I guess in 2018. He had always talked podcasts. He's like, man, you got to listen to The Ringer. You got to listen to Pardon My Take, like all these. And I was like, I don't know. I just kind of like to throw on XM radio and jam out when I'm driving. You know, podcasts have never really been my cup of tea. And I start listening to them and I love them. And then you start looking around, you're like, man, there's not a ton of baseball players doing podcasts. Like, we could find a little niche in there and get some. You know, at the time I was a Dodger, and you look around that locker room and it's just A-listers, right? I mean, it's just all-star after all-star. And you think, okay, I have an awesome network of guys to pull from, and you have a kind of an open, candid conversation. You're not going to necessarily get the take it one game at a time and God willing, I'm going to pull through. And like kind of those, you know, go-to answers that you get from athletes in the locker room post games, but more have an open discussion player to player. When we kind of thought about it, we're like, man, this seems like a great idea. Let's go with it. And gosh, 100 something episodes later, we're still cooking.
Yeah, it's really cool. And it's like you said, almost like that Players Tribune style. There's a bit more candor, you know, than you might get if a player is talking to me or Arden or people in the media. And it's fun to hear that behind the scenes stuff. And I wanted to ask you too about your most recent episode, because I was listening in and I found this really fun, because it's pretty rare that an athlete will weigh in on the league that they're in when it comes to making any kind of candid prediction or prognostication. And you guys were on there making your MVP picks, your Cy Young picks. I mean, you're eligible for these awards, and here you are making these picks. So, you know, I just wanted to ask you, you know, how did you get to that point of just being comfortable throwing that stuff out there and saying, yeah, I think Gerrit Cole's the favorite for Cy Young in the American League?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's one of those things that when you say it, you still don't necessarily feel great about it, and you're probably setting yourself up for some backlash. I remember that's also become one of our favorite episodes to do. This is now the third one we've been able to predict the awards for the baseball season. I've yet to get one right. Cooper got one right last year with Shane Bieber, of all people, somehow picked that as AL Cy Young. That's such a good call.
It's a good one.
At first, man, I really thought about that stuff, and I was hard on myself and didn't want to rub anyone the wrong way, and I still definitely feel that way, but as you start opening up more and saying things like that and even talking about teams in your division, and I've been very outspoken about my struggles against Mike Trout and Nolan Arenado and Javi Baez, and I think people like to hear that, you know, and you mentioned the candor side of it. You know, I think that fans enjoy hearing players be vulnerable and talk about stuff like that, and, you know, for one, I haven't received, knock on wood, a bunch of backlash on Twitter for some of the things that I say, and also I have my wife, who's the best PR person I have, who listens into episodes and stuff like that. You just kind of learn as you go, and as you get comfortable, you know, you open up more and more, man. Like I said, we've done over 100 episodes, so it's easy now. It's easy to talk about those kind of things and be open and honest about what I see around our game and the players, whether they're in my division or on my rival team or whatever, man. They're the best players. They deserve to be mentioned, and that's why I chose Gerrit Cole as the AL Cy Young.
Yeah, it's pretty good as a podcast host when you can open up the old iPhone contacts and there's, you know, Cody Bellinger, Clayton yeah. Kershaw. That's pretty good. You don't really need much of a chase producer when you're sharing a locker room with those guys. I mean, Clayton Kershaw, living legend, obviously. I want to ask you about a couple teammates that you've had, but just what's it like to kind of, you know, share a pitching staff with that guy and get to be around him and watch him work and watch how his career has progressed over the last several seasons?
Yeah, I'm so lucky, you know, really I am, to be his teammate for the five seasons that I was. Clayton is very much a leader by example. He's not going to necessarily go out of his way to come put his arm around your shoulder and say, like, here, you know, hey kid, this is how it's done. But you just learn from osmosis from him. Like, you just watch him go about his business. He shows up to the park every day, and there's just commitment and conviction to everything that he does. And honestly, for the first couple of years, I followed him around like a puppy dog. I mean, I just like did what he did. It just naturally rubs off on you, man. The competition on the mound is where he sets himself apart, right? I mean, there's games where he was hurt. He was throwing like 84 against the Reds, I think, in 2017 or 18. No business being out there pitching. We're in the dugout. Like, why is Clayton out there? And he goes five shutout, throwing 84 miles an hour. And he just out-competes and out-wills people. And that's something that I kind of struggle with, I think. You know, for one, to have that kind of confidence in the big leagues is tough. These are the best hitters in the world. I throw 90 miles an hour. How am I going to get them out consistently? And then you see Clayton do it all the time and never back down to anybody. 2-0, 3-1, he's challenging you and he's going to make you beat him. And that's the kind of stuff you learn from him. Obviously the work ethic stuff too. And I think about it all the time, just how late. It was his birthday today. This is Friday the 19th. It was his birthday today. I texted him first thing when I woke up, happy birthday, man. Miss you. You know, thanks for everything. It just, I don't know, I sound like a broken record, but just really, really grateful for the time I had around him.
All right. Happy birthday, Clayton. It's funny you talk about the confidence aspect. Something I've been thinking about a lot is just the confidence needed to pitch in the big leagues and just how much of a separator that can be at that level. And I'm curious for, you know, just to kind of hear your process of how you've developed that confidence, because you kind of mentioned it's, you know, at times maybe been a little bit of a struggle for you. And you're a guy who, like, you know, was not blue chip prospects, right? Like, you know, went to school like academically, like didn't necessarily go to school to pitch, walked onto a college pitching staff, and you've had to earn everything in this game. So like, how much have you had to work at developing that confidence and that swagger that you actually need on the mound to compete in the big leagues?
It comes and goes, man. And you get it more with experience, right? At first, especially like the stuff that you mentioned, like I was never really drafted as saying like, this guy's definitely going to make it to the big leagues. This guy's going to play 10 years in the big leagues, you know, like a Walker Buehler, who you look at in the first time he takes a big league mound, he knows he belongs there, right? He's belonged there since he was 19 years old, throwing 100 miles an hour at Vanderbilt. Like, it just, you knew that was coming. For me, it felt like I really had, you know, I had to go earn it. And then when I got the opportunity, it's like, oh my gosh, do I actually belong here? You know, and I'm facing the Giants in San Francisco. You're going like through Buster Posey and Brandon Belt and Joe Panic. And you're like, gosh, like, what do I have that these guys have never seen before? And man, you just tough it out and you go out there and you start mixing it up, changing speeds, changing eye levels, throwing the kitchen sink at them. And you start having a little success. And then it's the big leagues, man, it'll beat you down. Got sent down in the minor leagues my rookie year again the next year in 2017, been switched from starter to bullpen. All those things that feel like demotions and are demotions, and your confidence can waver. It's easy. This is a humbling game. Hitters get out 70%. The best hitters in the world get out 70% of the time. And then pitching obviously is really hard in its own right. So, man, that's the biggest challenge and something that's coming around in the game now and really across sports is the mental health and the mental side of sports and how it can just wear you down. Think about how long our season is, man. 162 games. You got to survive it somehow, you know, both physically and mentally. And anyways, long way to answer your question is it comes and goes, man. It really does. You ride the roller coaster and you can't get too high and you can't get too low. You're even Max Scherzer, Clayton Kershaw, like we just talked, will have bad outings, but it's those guys that take the ball again the next time and throw the ball with conviction, expecting to have success. And you just build confidence that way.
You know, going back to Kershaw and some of the elite players on that Dodgers team, or really at any point that you've come across in your career, are there little things that they do behind the scenes? Because, you know, I'm thinking really in most fields, there are people who distinguish themselves. And oftentimes it's not necessarily that they do everything leaps and bounds better, but sometimes it really is those little things that they separate themselves with. So can you think of anything with Kershaw or other teammates that you've had where you've noticed something and kind of taken away something from their approach?
Yeah, sure. Gosh, you could go down the line. Clayton, we are just touched on is just like the type A personality of just almost every minute to the day is planned to a T to get him ready for that fifth day, where if he takes the ball and doesn't have success on that fifth day, he can't look back and say, well, on day three, I mailed in my core regiment. You know, he does not do that. That will never happen to Clayton. Rich Hill, just sheer like tenacity on the mound. I mean, he's as happy-go-lucky goofball. And then when the lights come on and he's on the mound, I mean, he just goes to a, like an assassin mode to another level. Mookie Betts, attention to detail. Man, I tell you what, it changed the culture over there in LA. It was already very detail-oriented. And then you bring in Mookie, who just heightens everything. I mean, he's finding guys for making errors in spring training games and in wow. spring training practice. Wow. And just making everything that more finite and, you know, bringing attention to every little detail. Really, and just, I mean, it stems from the front office, too. Think about the organization coming down and you know, how prepared everyone is, whether you believe in the shift or not, believe in analytics or not. They are so prepared in the Dodgers organization against every hitter, scouting report, where we're going to play him in the field, how we're going to pitch him, all this stuff. When the playoffs come around, man, that's the kind of stuff that matters, and they're elite at that.
Man, you mentioned Rich Hill, who is like one of my favorite pitchers to watch over the last several years. You think about the way that guy uses his curveball. It's unbelievable what he's able to do into like his late 30s as well. You're a pretty big curveball guy yourself, had a lot of success with it in the Dodgers organization. We started using it more often. Did he give you any pointers? Did you pick anything up from him? Because he probably spins one of the nicest ones in the majors.
Yeah, gosh, I wish every big leaguer, I wish every human being that likes baseball could play catch with Rich Hill. He is the first guy that at 200 feet, the ball hits you the same as 60 feet. Like the first guy that I saw, he throws 87 miles an hour. And you're like, okay, that's what like true spin and spin rate and spin efficiency is. I mean, it's incredible. And then you see his curveball. It almost has two breaks. It'll like break left to right, and then it'll break downwards. It like catches twice. And he can change the shape, he can change his arm angle on it, and speed, everything, you know, just really good feel for that breaking ball. And as a two-pitch guy, that's the kind of weapon you got to have to survive multiple times through the lineup as he does. And what I learned from him really is the conviction behind the curveball, which is, I mean, Tyler Glasnow kind of says the same thing, Clayton Kershaw, guys that throw big curveballs usually say the same thing, is that the second you try and baby it, you're done. For one, you're giving it up to the hitter, it's going to pop out of your hand. You have to throw it almost harder than your heater, right? And you got to try and throw it on a dart. Throw it 55 feet before it catches on a line, right? Because it's kind of come out maybe belly button high, maybe even a little bit higher on a hitter, look like a fastball up, which is great in today's game with a lot of fastballs up. And then it's going to catch as it gets to the plate, fall to the, you know, strike zone or below. That was always a Rich Hill thing. It's like, how far can I throw it before it catches and starts to break? Because the longer you can get it tunneling, you know, talking drive line, Trevor Bauer terms here, tunneling, how far can I get it towards the hitter looking like a heater before it makes its move?
Your curveball's got a ton of break. And I think that for the common fan, when you see some, you know, a pitcher on the mound who's struggling to command his curveball, and you, you know, pitchers wear it on their sleeves, right? When they don't have their command on a given day. Like, can you even just explain what goes into maintaining the command on a curveball that breaks as much of yours, and how much of a challenge it is, not only on start days, but like in between start days and bullpens, and how much work really goes into being able to throw that thing in the strike zone?
Yeah, great question. You know, mine has 18 to 20 inches of break, you know, so I'm trying to drop that thing in. For one, the plate's only 17 inches wide. And then obviously you've got the up down strike zone as well. What I've learned is throwing it flat ground is tough, right? Because it's a totally different feel than throwing it off the slope. So now I'm playing catch on a flat earth, throwing a curveball. I got to aim it 12 inches or more higher than I would in the game. So you get a feel for it flat ground. You're like, okay, there it is. And then you go stand on the rubber and you're 18 inches higher than you just were. And now you got to find it all over again, right? Now I'm moving down the slope at a much faster pace, obviously a different angle, you know, talking about 20 inches of break, man. So everyone has different things that they think of with the curveball. As far as, do I pick out a starting point? Like for a strike, I aim it at the umpire's mask. For short, I aim it at my catcher's chest. Do I just aim at the glove and try and get it there? Do some people aim at the hitter's arm, like at his elbow, and try and drop it in, you know, and you start picking things from other people, trying them out. And when things aren't going well with that curveball, I'm not landing it. You'll try everything under the sun just to do it. And then you can get lost easily. But, you know, the biggest thing really, and that I touched on with the last question, is it's typically better if you just rip it, just throw it as hard as you can. It's going to at least look like a strike for a long time, and you're going to have a much better conviction behind it and a chance that the hitter is going to bite on it than just kind of lollipopping one in there.
All right. So Rich Hill, he's up there in age, even Clayton Kershaw, you know, he's into his 30s. And so many of the game's best pitchers are in their 30s, you know, whether it's DeGrom, whether it's Yu Darvish, Trevor Bauer, Scherzer, Verlander, it seems like that's the cohort of the game's best pitchers right now. And obviously, there's so much hype around guys like Manoah and Jay's camp right now, or Nate Pearson a year ago, and even now, of course. But it's tough, obviously, or else more guys would succeed at the first moment, you know, 21, 22, in the way that we see from some position players. So what's your theory on this? Do you have any insight? Obviously, I mean, pitching is really hard and it takes time, but why do you think that is?
Man, great question. I wish you would have sent me that one ahead of time. I could have thought about it a little bit yeah. more. You know, off the cuff, first thing I think of is a lot of those guys do have success early, right? And you'll come up and you'll see them do really well right off the bat. And then this game learns you, right? The hitters get information on you. The coaches on the other teams get information on you. They can put a program together and a plan against you so that the next time they see you, they got a much better idea of what's coming and what it looks like. You know, the old kind of beginner's luck kind of theory or whatever. And it's just, dude, it's just a really hard game. And the guys that stick around a long time, like the guys you just mentioned, Verlander, Scherzer, Kershaw, they have elite arsenals and they throw any pitch in any count. And, you know, today we have a lot of really good young arms, but they throw really hard. And that might be their best weapon. And these hitters can hit bullets, man. They've seen now 90 plus miles an hour for years. And all the guys out of the bullpen just throwing the nastiest stuff you can think of. These hitters can time up a bullet. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily matter if you get called up and you throw 97 for seven innings now. You got to be able to change speeds, change eye levels, and make them uncomfortable in the box. And, you know, off the top of my head, that would be the reason I would say the young guys aren't having, you know, success into like year two, year three. It's a learning curve, man. You got to figure out another way to keep these hitters off balance.
For sure. And I mean, you've touched on some of this in our discussion so far, but I guess for you, like, what are some of the ways that you're better as a pitcher now than you were when you first broke in?
The ability to plan. You know, at first I was overwhelming myself trying to take on too much information. I wanted to know exactly what Nolan Arenado hit against 2-1 sliders down and away, right? Exactly what Charlie Blackman hit against 1-0 changeups. And you're on the mound and I'm just overloaded with information. I'm just bogged down and I'm thinking about too much instead of just attacking the hitter. And you start to pick and choose exactly what you want from a scouting report. And I don't get that in depth anymore. I still want to have an idea of what can I get ahead with? What's good in mid counts? What good to put them away with? What gets a ground ball? Like more overarching themes, not like pinpoint counts and pitches. And two, kind of the confidence thing you touched on a little bit earlier, right? Just if I can land my curveball, odds are I'm at least going to be pretty competitive that day. if I can change, if, you know, I got four pitches, if I feel confident that I can throw any of them in any count on that day, that gives you confidence for sure. Man, good question. I guess you just get, you know, that's pitching. You just get smarter as you log innings and you get the ability to navigate through lineups and through innings and understand that if a base is open and a guy's on second and Nolan Arenado, I keep coming to him's in the box, it's okay to maybe pitch around him a little bit. Like the things that the game speeds up on you early, and then now a couple hundred innings under my belt, those kind of things come to mind better when, you know, the game's really fast around you and you're in a tough situation, first and third, one out, whatever. You can take a deep breath, ignore the 50,000 people screaming at you, and just lock in on the moment.
How much of a technology guy are you when it comes to some of the Rapsodo data that you can get, Edgertronic video you can get? Like, thinking about, you know, Rich Hill, man, like if he had some of that stuff in 2005 when he was breaking into the league, like imagine what he could have done with some of his pitches. So how much has that stuff helped you over the last few years? I know the Dodgers are big investors in it.
Yeah, it's a massive part of the game, and you have to buy in because, one, it makes you better. There's just no doubt about it. Now, it can bog you down if you try and tackle too many things at once. And or if you get frustrated by, you know, I'm trying to get 18 inches of vertical rise on my heater and I can't get above 15 inches and you're just working your tail off and it's not happening for you, like that can be very frustrating. And maybe that's just not your game. But to answer your question, man, I like it a lot. I love the slow motion cameras. I like to be able to capture the moments when I feel really good. You know, how is my curveball coming out of my hand? How's my changeup coming out of my hand when those pitches are feeling really good down the slope? So that when August rolls around and I don't know where my changeup's going, I can go back to that video and be like, oh, it was coming off my index finger. I thought it was coming off my middle finger this whole time. Whatever. I really like those. And then, you know, the spin rate stuff, the TrackMan Rapsodo stuff, I like it because of the same thing I kind of just touched on. It shows you where you were when you were good. You know, oh, my slider was really good. And in May, well, it had 6 inches of horizontal movement. Right now it has 13 inches. Like, it's much bigger. What happened? I must be getting around it. You know, those kind of things that you can really use for pitch design and to go back to the basics of when you were good and why that arsenal was working then. And it's part of the game, man. You got to buy in on it. It'll make you better. You just can't get lost.
So, you know, as a journalist, to try to be objective and try to, you know, not get too swayed one way or the other, but I do try to remain a fan of the sport, a fan of the game of baseball. And I get a sense, you know, from listening to your podcast a little bit, that you're a sports fan. As you've still progressed into professional sports, been a pro athlete now for years and years, it doesn't seem like you've lost that part, even for baseball. How have you balanced that?
You know, I'm a numbers guy and I'm a nerd, whether it's baseball or another sport. You know, Cooper, my co-host, loves basketball. I didn't watch a lot of basketball up until maybe 2 or 3 years ago when he really put it on the map for me. And now I got a fantasy basketball team and I'm, you know, running the bracket show in March Madness in the locker room. And I always love the NFL. My gosh, love the NFL. Fantasy football guy like crazy. You know, I used to have a lot of spare time on my hands for sure, especially in the off season. That's football time. So just sit on Saturday, watch some college football, sit down on Sunday and watch the NFL. You know, you read articles like what you guys put out there and you guys are really good at your jobs, man. It makes it fun to read and learn new stuff about athletes across the world in different sports. It's just, you know, that's part of the reason why I started the podcast too, is you can just show personality of athletes that people weren't getting as much as 10 years ago, right? Before social media and all that kind of stuff. Think about the access we have to athletes now. You know, I feel like I know LeBron James on a personal level because of how much I see him on my screens every day. You know, obviously that's not the case, but that's how close you can feel to an athlete in 2021.
And I think the most fans by now are aware that you're a licensed investment advisor and it's something that's been well documented, but there is like a very specific story with regards to that I want to ask you about. And just for folks who don't know, in order to become a registered broker in the United States, like Ross is, you have to pass what's called the Series 7 exam. And that's how you get your license to buy and sell securities. And you took yours when you were with the Dodgers, which is pretty impressive as it is, being able to juggle being a professional pitcher and preparing for that thing. But what's most impressive to me, Ross, is that as the story goes, you consumed a margarita during the exam. So can you please share for us and the listeners the story behind that one?
Of course. So believe it or not, that is the other exam I had to take. That one's called the 66. So I passed the 7. That the 7 is just like regurgitating terms. I mean, that one, if you just sit and study and memorize, you're going to pass it. What's a bond? What's an option? What's a stock? All these things. The 66 is written by lawyers and it's much more situational. And it'll say, you know, like client X wants to invest $100,000, what would you do? And then it'll give you like four Roman numerals, and then it'll say like A, Roman numeral 1 and 4. B, Roman numeral 1, 4, but not 2 or whatever, you know, and you're like, oh my gosh, this is the most annoying test I've ever had to take. So they split it up. It's 100 multiple choice, and then you get an hour intermission, and then it's another 100 multiple choice, I think. There's a Papacito's right next door, which is like a chain Mexican food restaurant in Texas that you guys definitely should hit up. It's phenomenal. And I got an hour to kill, so I just crossed the street, and I felt like I got whooped on the first half. I mean, just whooped, man. So I'm like, gosh, I just spent a whole off season studying for this. It's gonna be a waste of time. I gotta get like a 74 on it. I feel like at the time I'm like rocking a 40, and I'm just like, all right, give me margarita, like margarita on the rocks. Let's settle down a little bit. And killed that hour, went back in, and I guess did just well enough on the second half. I passed by 1 point. So that was a lucky margarita, no doubt.
That's amazing. I'll have to check out that place sometime. So, you know, I was looking up some of these videos to understand, you know, like what it is that you do. And I come across these kind of Fox Business guest segments that you're on. And like, yeah, it's a different language. I could not understand what you were saying. Like, it's a totally, it must be what people feel like when they hear us talk about sports, because it's like totally this different language. So do you ever have teammates that come up to you and that maybe hear you on the phone or something and they maybe don't know? And it's like, whoa, what are you talking about?
Yes, all the time. And it is the most fun thing, man. I love it. That's been the best part about this whole thing, getting licensed and really understanding the finance world, is the help that I've been able to give to teammates, coaches, staff, anyone under the sun, really. You know, you run into all sorts of people in a baseball facility that find out what I do on the side, and they ask you questions, and they, you know, they'll say, you know, hey, should I buy this SPAC? What is a SPAC? You know, and you got to try and explain what a SPAC is to someone, which, you know, barely makes any sense. And the difference between bonds and ETFs and mutual funds and all these things that people ask, that, like you said, you know, to me, I learned them when I was 17 years old from my grandfather and just thought that was part of the world. Everyone knows how to take care of their money. And then you get here and there's guys making millions and millions of dollars who may not even have their login to their brokerage account. So to be able to help them out as much as I can, it's been so much fun, and definitely the best part of the gig by far, is because, you know, you get to like see the light bulb go off and they're like, oh, I get it now. And that's always awesome.
Well, it's interesting because I think there are actually a lot of similarities between the finance world and Major League Baseball, like particularly with the way the front offices construct their teams and acquire players. Like, you think about the ways that investors will use like probability analysis or regression models. Like, front offices are doing the same thing, right? The due diligence investors are doing on companies, front offices are doing on you, Ross, and are, yep, doing on athletes and trying to predict human performance. So for you, understanding the financial side of it, I wonder like if it gives you a bit of a unique perspective on how it occurs within MLB as a player yourself, and just how you feel about how front offices are using some of these tools to try to predict that human performance, and then in turn, like how you are ultimately compensated.
You're spot on. The business side of baseball is sometimes the most frustrating for us as players, right? Where you know, for instance, I got traded at the deadline from the Dodgers, thinking I was going to no doubt be there for the rest of the year, go compete for a World Series. And I get a call at the deadline saying I'm going to Toronto. And that's the business side of it, right? Didn't see it coming at all. And, you know, both are very numbers oriented, obviously finances, but baseball is too, man, especially modern baseball, very analytical. And you can kind of put a number on anything. I believe I was listening to y'all's podcast. Y'all were talking about the catapult, right?
Yeah.
Which is this thing we're wearing where it looks like all of our guys have bras on, basically. And it's like this little thing that's measuring your output, how many throws and the stress that you're putting on your body and all this stuff to basically measure fatigue and how we feel on that given day. Well, 3, 4, 5 years ago, the old guys in the locker room, the veterans were saying, do not ever put those things on, ever. They will use it against you in arbitration, all this stuff. And so for years, we believed that. Don't use the Rapsodo. Don't use the TrackMan. They're just going to use this and tell you you're fatiguing, you stink, you're not doing any good anymore. And it's a reason to get you out of there, kick you out of the rotation, option you, whatever. You know, I think it actually hurts some guys, because now you use these things to your advantage and you take advantage. You know, if the catapult tells you you're not feeling that good, take that day. Go light that day. If you use the Rapsodo, like we touched on a couple questions ago, to get better, to find a better fastball, to use pitch design to find the changeup a little better, to find what axis it's rotating on, does that match my fastball? All these things that you can use that information to get better. And I know I totally got off what your question was. I went on a rant here, but I like that we're finally now trusting that information, not thinking that the organization is going to use everything against us like we did 4 or 5 years ago.
I want to run some of these minor league rule changes by you just because like some of them are pretty out there and I want to get a pitcher's perspective on them. So the ones that really like apply to you as a pitcher would be the step off rule. You know, you got to step off in high A before you can actually throw to a base. So then the pickoff limit, you only throw twice, throw the third time. You got to either get the guy or it's a balk. And then the automated strike zone. I mean, how do you feel about some of these rule changes that are coming up through the minors right now?
As a big curveball thrower, I love the automated strike zone because I can throw a curveball that will literally bounce on the back of the plate and will just clip the bottom of the strike zone and get a strike. I mean, it
slow
really,
pitch style.
Yeah, it can work in my favor in that way. I do think, and now this is a battle we do in the locker room all the time. You get guys with different opinions. I think it benefits the hitters more because I think sometimes hitters spend a full turn around the lineup or maybe more, multiple innings, just to figure out where the ump strike zone is that day. Right. So now they get the same strike zone for 162 games. They know from the second they step in their first at bat exactly where that strike zone is. And these guys got 20/15 vision. They're the best hitters in the world. Now they know exactly where the black is on both sides of the plate. I mean, that's a huge advantage to them. I do like the human element of the strike zone. You know, I do hope that I'm out of the game before the automated strike zone comes in. I like baseball the way it is, at least in that regard. And then, the pickoff one drives me nuts, man. I think they did a study and they found that fans like stolen bases a lot. Like, I don't know if they just like handed out a thing in ballpark and fans just all wrote down, yeah, we love stolen bases. I genuinely think that's true. I'm not like making that up. I think they did a study and found that. And so they're trying to bring that element back into the game and it is exciting and it's really not a part of baseball anymore. Now it's draw a walk and hit a 2-run homer. You know, it's not really hit a single, steal second, bunt them over, hit a sack fly. Like that's not baseball anymore. And I agree that we probably need to find a happy medium between those two versions of baseball, but I don't know if not letting us pick off and all that kind of stuff is the answer.
The one for me is the defensive positioning. I hate that one. I just like you. That's the game. Line guys up wherever you're going to line them up. I don't like the idea of having to have two on either side of second base.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I don't know how I feel about that one. You can get so over analytical in baseball, right? Where Justin Turner's hanging out in shallow right field, throwing guys out at first. And that, how frustrating that is for like a Joey Gallo who hits a ball 115 miles an hour and he's out at first base from right field, you know?
I don't like that rule either. I think you got to let the fielders play where they, because even going back to Ted Williams, they've always played, you know, various configurations. So I don't think that you have to artificially restrict fielders.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm not going to fight you on that one either.
Yeah.
How about, do you guys believe that hitters hit into the shift because that's just where they hit it and they're punching out more because they're trying to hit it out of the shift, trying to hit homers because of the shift? Or do you think that the shift just works? I don't know. Does how I'm phrasing that make sense?
I think hitters get paid for damage. And I think the damage is doubles, triples, and homers, right?
Yeah.
Like I think the damage is slugging percentage. Damage is exit velo. So like that's what, and so naturally, I think the ball ends up going into the shift. I think that like some really good hitters with some really high OPSs could probably hit the ball the other way just fine, but maybe not for as much damage.
Yeah.
So they'd much rather put up big power numbers because that's what gets paid in this game. That goes back to the stolen base thing, right? Bags don't get you paid anymore.
Right.
Stealing a bunch of, if you like compensate guys for stealing a bunch of bases, I promise you guys will steal a bunch of bases, but they're not getting compensated for that. And actually getting caught stealing a base is now hurting your wins above replacement. So why would you even take the risk? Right.
Yeah.
So,
spot on. Yeah.
Even with, you know, something like bunting, right? Like I think there are a lot of fans who kind of wish that hitters would, you know, when they're shifted against it, they would just bunt it to the left side, you know, take your single. But I think that, you know, it's way, way harder. And you would know this. You've pitched in the National League, you've hit in the National League. Like there's no way that it's easy to just, you know, quote unquote, drop a bunt down for a base hit. Like pitchers are too good for that to be doable.
Yep. I agree completely. I hate bunting with a passion. I was never any good at it and I do not want to do it anymore. And I tell you what, as a pitcher, I don't care. Like a Jock Peterson, a Yasmani Grandal, guys I played with in LA that would try that bunt all the time. Like they're not fast. Yeah. Go to first base. Yasmani Grandal. Like I'm not even going to worry about you. And you have the ability to hit 40 homers and now you're just standing on first base. I'll worry about the next guy. So as a pitcher, you gave up a hit and there's a guy on base and all that goes into it. But a lot of times those guys doing it are sluggers, right? Anthony Rizzo. And you're like, dude, yeah, go to first base.
Right. Well, and the worst part as a pitcher trying to bunt is that the pitcher on the mound knows that you're trying to bunt. So like for you, when you know you've got a pitcher who's trying to bunt, like what are you throwing? Like what is your approach to throw, you know, the hardest pitch to lay down for a bunt?
Yeah, it's my curveball for sure, yeah. Because I've tried to bunt other guys' curveballs. And I feel like there's kind of an unspoken rule that you give them like one, you know, here's a fastball on the plate. Good luck. And if they don't get it down, all right, you're getting, you know, my nastiest stuff. You missed your one chance. And I don't even know if that really exists anymore. It depends on the situation. Like if a guy's on second, no outs, and you're trying to bunt him to third, I'm probably throwing you all curveballs. Like I do not want that guy to get to third with less than two outs. But if it's just guy on first, one out, pitcher's up, yeah, I'll give you one on the plate. Good luck. If not, I'm going for the punch out.
That is one rule that I will be happy to see is when it's just DH in both leagues. Because and Ben disagrees with me. Ben loves seeing pitchers hit.
Sorry, Ross.
But I just don't. I think it's. Yeah. I think the era is past, and it's time to just let pitchers pitch and hitters hit.
I just don't want to see guys get hurt, right? Like yeah. Jimmy Nelson, who basically hasn't pitched since 2017. How good he was for Milwaukee, gets hurt diving back into first base. Adam Wainwright missed a season from hitting. Alex Wood was my teammate in 2016 who missed a bunch of time because he overextended his elbow, hyperextended his elbow hitting. Like if we can somehow limit, you know, superstar pitchers from getting injured hitting, yeah, it brings a cool little element to the game. It keeps the division separate from each other. But man, if you have stars missing entire seasons because of injuries due to hitting, you know, it's hard to make the argument that that's worth it.
And there's nothing stopping a team like from throwing Zach Greinke up there to hit in a pinch hit spot. If you think he's your best option, you could still put him up there.
Yeah.
You're still going to get pitchers hitting occasionally, I would imagine, if he really is the best option, or like a Marcus Stroman who would pinch run sometimes for the Blue Jays when he was here. Like you could still use guys in that role. We just don't need the starter who never works on it up there trying to hit.
Right. I know a lot of guys like it for the strategy, right? Now that I've played in the American League, you kind of see it, you know, Charlie Montoya runs out of team and that's going to be the team for nine innings versus the Dodgers. Every position player was probably going to get some action during that nine innings. At some point, Kike was going to defensive replace Chris Taylor, defensive replace. You're going to hit the lefty off the bench. You're going to hit the righty off the bench the next inning because of the matchups. Like that strategy in the NL is cool. So I get it for that reason. But as far as if your argument is just like, I want to see pitchers hit, I can't really defend you there.
That's for sure. No, it's, and I think too, like you have the occasional payoff that's like, oh my God, Bartolo Colon just hit a home run. It's so fun. And everyone's like excited about it. But nobody's thinking about the thousands of times that it's 1, 2, 3 whiff. And we all forget about those.
Yeah. Well, and as a pitcher, man, I loved it because you get, you know, I always talk about the Rockies because you got to survive, especially my first couple of years, you got to get through Blackman, LeMahieu, Arenado, Story. And then you can kind of grind through whoever 5-6 is there. And then all this, you got the catcher and the pitcher, right? And, you know, a lot of catchers aren't necessarily automatic outs. I'm not saying that by any means, but definitely easier than Nolan Arenado and Charlie Blackman, right? So now I can kind of not relax, but, you know, take it off the gas a little bit, get the catcher and the pitcher out, and then gear up again to go through that gauntlet. The American League, that doesn't exist, you know, especially in this division, man. It's 1 through 9 in today's game, and the American League can hit a homer at any time.
Absolutely. Hey, on your team as well, by the way. So
yeah, I know. Man, I was pitching in the game last week against the Phillies, and every half inning I was sitting there for 20 minutes because we put up like 19 hits or something. It's like, gosh, man, maybe 3 lasers at someone. Let me get an inning in real quick.
Well, Ross, you've been very generous with your time. We thank you for coming on. It's the Big Swing Podcast. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. You can see Ross on the mound for the Toronto Blue Jays. Thanks a lot, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Our thanks to Ross Stripling for joining us this week on At The Letters. Our thanks to Mike Tassoni and Christian Ryan for producing. Ben's on Twitter at BNicholsonSmith. I'm Arden Zwelling on Twitter at Arden Zwelling. And we will talk to you next time on At The Letters.